The sort of things we focused on were disruption to the power supplies and what we could do to mitigate them, disruption to satellites in low Earth orbit, the importance of space traffic management, the importance of disruption to communications. For example, the errors in GPS signals, it grew to something like 60 metres.
Oh, wow, okay.
Over the USA.
Welcome to Beyond the Ice, the podcast from British Antarctic Survey, where our polar science and operations experts brief you on the topics shaping our world. In today's episode, we're discussing space weather and the impact of solar storms. How is this related to polar science? Well, the polar regions are some of the best places in the world to study the phenomena shaping Earth's upper atmosphere and the nearby space environment, but more on that to come. I'm joined by Professor Richard Horn, who specialises in space weather, ionospheric physics and plasma physics. He's also the co-author of a 2026 report for the UK government on the worst case scenarios for a severe space weather event. He's looked at the likelihood of that risk, what the impact would be on infrastructure and people around the world. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Richard.
Nice to meet you, Emily.
There's probably nobody better to ask. What actually is a solar storm?
Most people might have heard of a solar flare and large eruptions on the sun. But one of the things which we're mostly concerned with are things called coronal mass ejections. Think of it like a huge, great big explosion on the sun, and it throws off into space billions of tons of charged particles, mostly electrons and protons. And they go out into space and they take with it some of the solar magnetic field. That's one kind of solar eruption which we're really concerned about. Another one would be a solar radiation storm where you have charged particles accelerated to extremely high energies either at the sun or in the close vicinity of the sun, and then they may come along to the Earth and penetrate the Earth's magnetic field and cause all kinds of disruption to electronic systems.
Okay, and just for the less physics-attuned among us, so they're moving through the vacuum of space, and this is just with the momentum of having exploded from the sun or flowing from the sun?
Yes, although space is not really a vacuum. There's always a magnetic field and charged particles in space between the sun and the Earth throughout the whole galaxy. Yes, it's pretty close to a vacuum, but there are charged particles, and they do have an important effect.
Okay, now we're getting into it. So we are on a polar science podcast. So the polar regions, I think people may know from things like the aurora, are a place where you can really kind of keenly observe things that are happening in Earth's atmosphere. Can you explain why Antarctica and the Arctic are so uniquely valuable as vantage points for studying space weather?
Okay, so best way to perhaps explain that is when we have a coronal mass ejection and it comes in the direction of the Earth, it sees the Earth's magnetic field as an obstacle. It tends to try and flow around it. But in some cases, the magnetic field in interplanetary space originating on the sun can connect to the Earth's magnetic field and then tear it open, rip it open, particularly over the polar regions, and distort the Earth's magnetic field. When it does that, it loads lots of energy into the Earth's magnetic field, and that gets translated into large electrical currents which flow in the polar regions. It flows from the outer regions of space down along the Earth's magnetic field into the polar regions, into the atmosphere, through the atmosphere, and out again. So going to the polar regions are actually high latitude regions, both in the north and the south, both in the Arctic and the Antarctic, is a really important place to go because that's where you need to measure these things.
Yeah.
And it's at those high latitudes, that's where they cause the damage, or one region where they cause damage and disruption to things like, for example, our power grids, which is really important. It's one of the major things that our government is concerned about. The Antarctic is also important because there are special differences, if you like, in the Antarctic compared to the Arctic. You know, they have magnetic field lines which go from the north to the south, and we can compare and contrast what happens in the north with what happens in the south, which is really important because the things are different. You might think they're actually the same, but they're not. They're really quite different.
I would never have assumed that they were different at all. Okay, right, blow my mind. So how are they different?
So the electrical currents of strength, the electrical currents that we measure in the Arctic and the Antarctic are different. They may have a timing offset. One may be stronger than the other because one's hemisphere is in sunlight, the other one isn't. That makes a big difference.
Really?
And we can separate out what things are controlled by solar illumination compared with what things are controlled by the geomagnetic field, the Earth's magnetic field. Because the offset between the geomagnetic pole and the geographic pole in the Antarctic is larger than it is in the northern hemisphere in the Arctic region.
Wow, they're offset at different levels.
That's right. So I can't remember.
Oh,
exactly
no, now we're really. Oh, no, I'm not going to test you. But we're getting into all sorts of nitty gritty here about things that I think you assume you know from, a GCSE school level explanation of our world. And then you start to kind of break those assumptions as soon as you talk to an expert.
That's right. I mean, it's those differences. They might sound small, but actually they help us to actually understand the physics and what's going on better by studying the differences and what they control. Another important reason for going to the Antarctic is that there's a weakness in the Earth's magnetic field. And as a result of that, charged particles can penetrate deeper into the atmosphere in the Antarctic than they can in the north. And that affects satellites which orbit through those regions. It causes additional radiation damage. And that can be significant. Satellite designers have to design for that. It's something they take into account. But when you have magnetic storms, that's when things really get interesting. That's when the radiation levels go way up. And we've got to be aware of that. What's the reasonable worst case?
Okay, so we kind of touched on this, but in the polar regions, what are the kind of instruments are set up to measure solar radiation and solar storms? And are there differences in kind of like geopolitical collections? What's going on?
Well, we make a variety of measurements in the Antarctic. We make measurements of the Earth's magnetic field, both on a long time scale, but also on a short time scale. I mean, like minutes, variations of the order of minutes. Because when the aurora takes place and we have a magnetic storm, there are large electrical currents that flow, and we can detect them by making measurements of the magnetic field on the ground. And those electrical currents cause damage to our power grids in the northern hemisphere, but we need to know how big they can be on the location. They're always changing, and they're always changing in location, they're changing in strength. By measuring those in the Antarctic, we can actually put models together and try to understand and estimate what the biggest currents or disruption could be. So that's one set of measurements that's really important for us. And we use a chain of magnetic field measurements, magnetometers. We also make measurements of special kinds of radio waves, very low frequency radio waves. They originate in space, but they're guided along the Earth's magnetic field down to the ground in the polar regions. And we pick them up at Halley, for example. We've done that for many years. And by studying those radio waves, we can then say something about what's happening out in space. So, for example, we use radio wave measurements in our basic research. And we showed that actually those waves, when they're in space, they can accelerate particles to extremely high energies, which cause damage to satellites. So that's how our basic research ends up in something useful and practical.
There is this 1859 event called the Carrington event, and that is regarded as the most extreme solar event recorded in history, crucially recorded. So your report draws on a much larger body of evidence, and that stretches back thousands of years, and you've looked at tree rings and ice cores. How can you see a solar storm in a tree ring?
Good question. Okay. What happens is the sun will emit charged particles, very high energy, and they can penetrate through the outer layers of the Earth's magnetic field and the outer layers of the atmosphere, particularly in the polar regions. And then they create various types of elements, isotopes, we call them. So they can create various forms of carbon, beryllium, and other things. And they get rained out in the atmosphere. They come down as snow, and they get compacted in the ice. And after many years, you can see the signature of those things in the ice cores. Similar sort of thing in tree rings. So the carbon gets absorbed by wood trees from many years ago. And by looking at that and do the, you can do sort of things like radiocarbon dating and look for those signatures of those isotopes and the amount of them, different years. You can work back and work out that there was a huge, great big solar storm, a radiation storm back in, actually one of the biggest ones was back in 660 BC.
Amazing.
And 10 times bigger, we estimate, or not we, but it has been estimated by some of our Japanese colleagues, 10 times bigger than anything we've seen in modern history.
Okay? Wow.
And when I say modern history, I mean since about 1955.
So what kind of picture does this paint about the kind of long-term behaviour of the sun? Is that something we should be expecting coming down the line soon, some scale event like that?
When we try and do an assessment of a reasonable worst case, and I emphasise the word reasonable worst case, okay, rather than something we can dream up, based on previous evidence. And you mentioned the Carrington storm. We consider that to be something like a 100 or 150-year event. And we try and sort of relate things back to that to try and assess a reasonable worst case in all kinds of different areas, whether it's radiation, atmospheric expansion, which affects satellites and other areas, effects on the power grid and so on. So the sun, as you probably know, goes through an 11-year cycle, and we can trace that back so far, back to some of the earliest records. But beyond that, or you know, if you want to go back thousands of years, we then have to go to tree rings and ice cores, and they give us partial information. It's not everything we want, but at least it gives us something that we can use to try and work out what is a 100-year event, how severe could it be, which is what we really need to know. So we can plan for the future and put in mitigation measures and try and design against something like that.
So presumably the occurrence of a major space weather event matters a lot more to us in terms of our actual lives and infrastructure in 2026 compared to a 660 solar event.
Or even one in 1859, right?
Yeah, or even 1859.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we rely these days so much more on modern technology. I mean, all our data communications go, or most of it goes by cable, but an awful lot is going by satellites. Communications are really, really important. Data transfer is really important. There are proposals to have data centers in space, you know.
It's all about the space economy now, isn't it? Yeah, the strategies are starting to come out.
There's that. There's power supplies are really, really important. We rely on those for in so many different ways. GPS signals, and they can be disrupted as well. Our modern way of life is so dependent. I mean, everyone's got a mobile phone, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just think, most people do mobile banking, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just think of a number of different ways that we rely on this in modern technology. And we've just got to make sure it's resilient, and we've got to sort of plan for a reasonable worst case. So it's going to keep working. That's what we're trying to do.
In a kind of, I guess, normal scale solar storm, what is the storm actually doing to the satellites?
A lot of satellites are geostationary. I mean, they're the traditional ones. They're the big things, which put up there in the last 15 years or thereabouts and more. So when we have a large geomagnetic storm, we can disrupt them. One of the key things is radiation exposure. So the levels of high-energy charged particles goes up, and it can damage the electronic components on those spacecraft. So it leads to malfunctions, service outage. And most of the time, a lot of the time, that can be recovered. But there are occasions when satellites have just gone. That's it, a loss. So Anik 1, Anik 2, Galaxy, can't remember which galaxy it was now, but offhand, but it was about $162 million. Payout. So those things are insured, and the insurance guys, you know, they like to know all the risks, and they like to ensure satellite operators, you know, take all reasonable precautions and things. And space weather is one of those things which they take into account. So damage to electronic components causing service outage, that's one thing. Of course, what's happened over the last few years is a huge increase in the number of satellites in low Earth orbit. Everyone might have heard of Starlink by now.
Right,
SpaceX Starlink, right? So there are about 9,000 satellites in low Earth orbit, altitude up to about 1,000 kilometres or thereabouts. Okay, not just Starlink, but there are other constellations too.
Yeah,
and that is planned to go to something like 60,000 satellites by 2030.
Oh, my goodness.
That's only about 4 years away.
Yeah.
So what happens when we have a large major magnetic storm is that those electrical currents I was mentioning earlier, associated with the aurora, but there are other currents as well, they heat the upper atmosphere. And the upper atmosphere expands and expands upwards. So all those spacecraft go through that, it affects their orbits. So the orbit prediction becomes really difficult now because they've got a more atmospheric drag, they're not going to be where you predicted them to be. So the atmosphere can expand upwards, and that affects the orbits of satellites in low Earth orbit. And that makes it more difficult to predict where they're going to be, and they may collide with other satellites.
I was going to say, it's getting busy up there.
It's getting really busy up there. And in addition to those satellites, you've got space debris. So there's something like 50,000 bits of space debris greater than 10 centimetres. It's all tracked. The Americans track it all. And they're trying to predict where it's going to be. And there's something like a million pieces which are greater than 1 centimetre.
Okay? And all of that would move.
And all that's going to move. You have a large magnetic storm, changes the atmosphere. They're not going to be where you think it's going to be. So you've got to do all the tracking, and you've got to do all the forecasting of where those things, and you've got to do the conjunction analysis. Are those things going to be, what you expect? Are you going to forecast a collision risk? So in our report, for example, just recently that we published, we had a large magnetic storm in May 2024. The number of collision conjunctions went up by about 35% just in that
month. Wow.
And that was largely over a period of just a few days. That's one of the kind of, I think, a growing risk where space weather is really having a, or going to have a real big impact.
Yeah, that's a really recent example of what you're pointing to here. Okay, so speaking of that co-authored paper for government, that was for a worst case scenario summary. So presumably this is a really, really big solar storm, statistically rare. So what is the picture of the damage that that statistically rare solar storm could wreak on the modern environment?
In May 2024, we had a very large magnetic storm, the biggest storm we've had for about 20 years. And it turned out to be a 1-in-20-year event. And myself and a committee that I run, I'm chair of a space environment impacts expert group, we thought it would be a really good thing to do an analysis of what happened during that storm and draw some lessons from it and see if there are things that we can learn and improve. Mm-hmm. So we set about doing a sort of a large report, which we've now published, and it's also gone to DSIT and other government departments for them to kind of look at. We made 14 recommendations. The sort of things we focused on were disruption to the power supplies and what we could do to mitigate them, disruption to satellites in low Earth orbit, the importance of space traffic management, the importance of disruption to communications. For example, the errors in GPS signals grew to something like 60 metres.
Oh, okay, wow, okay.
Over the USA, and it disrupted all their planting for farmers and planting crops and so on. There was disruption to communications with aircraft on high-latitude routes, and there's a whole variety of different sort of aspects. So we sort of tried to pull that together, and we tried to make sense of it, and then we tried to put that in a context to say, what do we need to do? And some of the learning lessons that came out are that we need to make more measurements in general, so particularly for power supplies. We need to really improve upon our forecasting and the time of arrival of an event, because we were sort of lucky in that space weather event. We had a scientific satellite in the right place that gave us earlier warning. And the accuracy of the time of arrival of it was a coronal mass ejection, or a whole series of coronal mass ejections coming from Sun to Earth. And typically, the error in forecasting the time of arrival is around about plus minus 13 hours.
Okay, so really short windows here.
So that's really bad. Usually it takes materials, Sun to Earth, it usually takes a couple of days.
Okay.
The fastest is about 14 and a half hours, Sun to Earth. Okay, give it a time scale. Our ability to predict the time of arrival is very poor. So we've got to improve upon that. That's a kind of science problem, but it's also an operational problem. But it gives us a steer. We learned from that, and now we can give the scientific community a steer of where to focus effort.
So in terms of those kind of gaps in our ability to really forecast this space weather, what are we missing scientifically or practically?
I think the fundamental problem that we have, or we need to address, is measurements. Measurements in the right place. And when I say that, I mean satellites. All mitigation depends upon accurate warning. And I was saying earlier that the uncertainty in our current forecasting of a time of arrival when a CME will reach the Earth is plus or minus 13 hours, something like that.
Yeah.
So we want to reduce that. And there are plans to try and do that. So, for example, we want to put up a spacecraft which will go to what we call the L5 position. That basically means that if you think of a line between the Sun and the Earth, it's sitting on the side. And it can see stuff coming off the Sun and going to the Earth, and it could give us a much better estimate of the time of arrival.
Right, near side observer. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. So it's called the Visual Mission, okay? And the UK is kind of one of the leaders on that mission within the European Space Agency. So that's one thing we can do. That gives us time of arrival, but it won't tell us how severe that storm's going to be. So the next thing on from there in our report that we're saying is that you really got to measure, you've got to assess the severity of the storm and its duration. When's it going to be okay again? When's it going to be okay to carry on as normal? To do that, we think we need space measurements. You need a spacecraft between the Sun and the Earth, but closer to the Sun than we currently have.
Right.
And the difficulty is, well, how do you do that? Because that spacecraft will just orbit around the Sun. So
right.
It's not going to be in the right place most of the time, right? The satellite designers, orbit designers, they're pretty clever guys, and they've come up with a solution to that. You end up with that four or five spacecraft in special orbit. We're going around the Sun, but it looks like they pass around the Earth every few hours, and that would give you advance warning. So that would give us something like 2 hours warning of the severity of the storm. So two space measurements, which we need measurements of the right stuff in the right place, and we haven't got those at the moment. That's how we can improve our forecasting. And then we're going to have to rely and improve our model forecasts as well.
Interesting. So you said the first spacecraft was kind of on the UK agenda in collaboration with ESA. When you supply this information to government, are you advising them and kind of encouraging them to look for international collaborations that might meet this need? Is that part of the brief?
Absolutely, yes. UK government has a minister. The minister goes along to ESA meetings every couple of years or thereabouts, and we talk about priorities, or they talk about priorities. But we provide some of the motivation in this case for why we need this mission and why it sort of feeds into our forecasting. And it's about protecting our critical national infrastructure, why this is so important. So it's different from a science mission. This is a much more directed mission, which will actually help us protect our infrastructure.
So is there anything that we can do when you know a solar storm is coming to protect a satellite, or is it the state of readiness for that disruption that's the important bit?
It's the state of readiness. I mean, there are things people can do. For example, on a spacecraft, you're going to delay an orbit manoeuvre. And we have had examples in the past where when a satellite operator has had a forecast of a storm's going to hit, they've brought forward a manoeuvre. They've taken the spacecraft out of its slot because they've got another one coming in. So if they want to fire thrusters and do anything like that, they want to do it in a period of low risk. They don't want to do anything that's disrupted. Delay updates, software updates. I mean, how many times does your computer get a software update, right? So, you know, you can plan that. You can delay that. There are things like that. You can have more people available to deal with any potential problems. You can warn your customers that the signals that they're relying on may be at risk for certain periods of time. Okay, so you can warn your users. Things like that, which are important, you know. But the spacecrafts are going to keep operating. They're going to keep going.
I can imagine also at a government level, you've got kind of operational awareness and then kind of preparedness for, I guess, national systems, national security, having a particular blip moment coming down the line. So that must be of interest to the government.
Yes, different departments. Yeah, I mean, the power grid is perhaps the most important thing for the government. Everybody relies on power supplies. So, for example, in that May 2024 storm I was talking about, the Met Office are the people who actually do the warning in the UK. They have an official space weather team. They consult with myself and a few members of the core siege group that I chair if they're going to go to the highest level of warning. And they did in that May 2024 storm, and they got it right. They did a forecast and they got it right. So in that storm, when they make a forecast and they say in that storm it was one of the highest that they've actually issued, it's called a G5, okay? That means government do things. They put it into action plans. They set up communications between government departments and they have a watch. So they're online and they're doing things. It's not, you know, they don't just go home, oh yeah, it's high risk. They do things. And until the risk has gone down. That's really important, getting that right. So one of the highest problems or one of the big concerns is maintaining the power supplies, making sure that we don't have outages and that everything carries on smoothly.
That's really interesting. I guess when you're framing this science and the probability of particular events to politicians, what are you thinking about as a scientist in terms of how to frame that science at the right scientific level, at the right level of urgency, and with the kind of the best utility for the different departments who might need it?
One of the difficulties is in this sort of subject is that it's complicated. There are so many different ways systems can be affected. And trying to put across simple messages is really important. But you've got to try and make sure you somehow you communicate that this is complex and there are systems that could be affected in different ways. That's really hard. Okay, one of the things we try and do is practice events. In the past, government departments have actually set up things, and we have a practice. I've attended some of those where the Met Office have come along, so provide a scenario. And then at this stage, at this time, what would you be doing? And myself and some of my colleagues as scientists would be actually saying, okay, have you thought of this? Have you thought this could happen, that could happen? Have you taken that into account?
Yeah.
Are you aware of this? Flow of information from A to B, okay, is disrupted. So you haven't got all the complete information. That's the sort of thing that's likely to happen. What are you going to do? Do you do anything? Having those practice sessions is really, really important. So I've taken part in some of those. I was involved in a practice SAGE meeting last year or so. They're illuminating. They're really good. Mm. And you learn from them. Hopefully we don't have one of these great big things.
But
if we do, that we at least we become more prepared than we ever have been.
It's about, I guess, like the new threats for the modern era, isn't it? And then kind of modelling them into national preparedness, national risk registers, and that at that kind of level.
That's right. And what we try and do is to say, well, this is, we think, a reasonable worst case of the environment. what the radiation levels could be, what the changes in the magnetic field could be, what the currents could be. And then the scientists, we also need to work with the guys in the companies as well as the agencies to try and assess what that impact would be on from there. And that's about working together. And that can also be a little difficult because not everybody really wants to share their data, so it's confidential and so on, and you get in a whole different kind of area. But what's really important is to build trust with those guys, not just in government, but also with the companies. Mm. So they trust you and do things. I did that with the insurance companies years ago, and I have contacts there now, which I've 25 years, I've now had for 25 years or so. And you get a surprising amount of information. Also with the satellite industry, the satellite operators. And when you talk to those guys, there's some things they can and cannot say when there's management in the room.
Oh, interesting.
And when management goes out and you go and have a drink with them afterwards, you find out what's really going on. And then you realise, okay, you're really interested in what we're doing and they're very supportive of what we're doing.
Yeah,
but they
course.
Can't always tell us the reason why. It's that commercial in confidence.
Yes.
And that's what you have to understand. And once you respect that, then you can build trust and then you can achieve things.
Nice. Looking at that picture as a whole, is there anything that particularly concerns you about our current state of readiness for a solar storm?
We have a Met Office system set up now. It's been functioning from just over 10 years or so, doing the forecasting. So I'd say we're probably in a better state now than we ever have been, which is great.
Love that.
We have the results of the SWIMMER program, which was a large program funded by UKRI under the Strategic Priorities Fund, where we developed large computer models in different areas, and we've delivered those to the Met Office. It was a directed program, and myself, Paul Cannon, were instrumental in writing the science case for that, along with Ian McRae. We wrote the science case for that, and we got it funded by the Strategic Priorities Fund through UKRI. That has come to an end, and those models are being delivered now to the Met Office for use operationally. And that's quite an issue to take a science model, put together with postdocs and students and everything, and then turn that into a professional bit of software, which is used operationally and is going to run 24/7 without any problems. But we've done that, and there are different groups that have been involved in that, which are delivered to the Met Office. So I'd say we're better prepared now than we have been in the past. I think the issue is that there are growing risks in certain areas. I would say the number of satellites being launched into low Earth orbit and the risk of those colliding and then creating more debris and going into a Kessler syndrome where we might render some orbit altitudes unusable. Yeah. I think that's a real and growing risk, and I think we've really got to address that more. And I think that's really about regulation to some extent, space traffic management. As things get smaller and smaller, electronic components get smaller and smaller, and we're going to use more and more databases and stuff like that. We need to try and assess the impact of high-energy charged particles with the cosmic rays, but actually from sun radiation storms. We need to look a little bit more carefully about the risks associated with that and evaluate them. Go down and evaluate them, try and work out, you know, what we need to do.
Well, now in this era where there seems to be so many satellites going up every 5 minutes, is there any international oversight on who's launching a satellite and where? Or is this an argument for some kind of regulation as to who is using our kind of near space?
Well, each country has launch facilities, so there is some international discussion agreement. Satellites have to be registered where they're going to go and what spectrum they're going to use for communications and so on. But one of the things I mean is like deorbiting strategy. So the Americans are just going to a deorbit strategy. At the end of your useful life, you remove that spacecraft within 5 years. As far as I understand, the UK and the European Space Agency still say 25 years. So we need to start looking at that and ideally reduce that, I think reduce that. Also, so you remove defunct satellites or the satellites, you reduce the risk of collisions. Also, I think space traffic management, how many satellites should you have in a certain range of altitudes? Okay, so if you've got lots and lots of people registering on a constellation, have they done the risk assessment of colliding here, there and everywhere? I think that needs more assessment. And then you think, well, how do the regulators know what's safe?
Mm.
They need support. They need models. They need analysis. And that's something the scientific community can provide to them or to help them with, if you like, to work out what is safe. And I think that's something that, we could get together with them and do more to help promote that. All these spacecraft which are going up, when you deorbit them, you know, they break up and they burn up in the atmosphere, right? But there's now growing concern that actually what you actually end up with is more and more sort of bits of aluminium, but on a very, very tiny scale, okay, floating around in the atmosphere as a result of that ablation.
Yes.
So you end up with, what's the environmental impact of that? So people are starting to look at, is there an environmental impact of all these spacecraft burning up in the upper atmosphere? So all that stuff comes down towards the upper end of the stratosphere. And the wind circulation up in the upper stratosphere is from the equatorial regions to the polar regions. So a lot of it gets transported to the polar regions, and then it will come down, because the polar regions get very cold, and it come down lower. And the issue there is, can that affect the ozone layer? Can that actually cause additional ozone loss? Now, that's a growing concern. It's an unquantified risk at the moment. But it is something I think is really, really important. And given that British Antarctic Survey discovered the ozone hole, Joe Farman and Co. back in, 1985, thereabouts? I think that's really, really important. I think it's a new environmental risk that needs to be evaluated.
Yeah, that's huge, particularly in the kind of wider climate warming context. We don't need more things messing with our climate. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Beyond the Ice. As ever, you'll be able to find a in-brief version of this discussion on LinkedIn and the British Antarctic Survey website. Before I go, some news. This will be the last episode of Beyond the Ice. But fear not, a new podcast from British Antarctic Survey is coming in the autumn. It's going to be full of energy, bigger and better, and we're looking forward to sharing it with you.